When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's just try to make the best shit we possibly can. And so we wrote like 40 plus songs and finished maybe 28 and just pared it down to the ones that all made sense together. And we're all kind of had a vibe that worked.
Welcome to Behind the Setlist, the podcast where artists tell the stories about the songs they perform live. I'm Jay Gilbert from Label Logic.
And I'm Glenn Peoples from Billboard. In this episode, we talk to the Black Keys. Well, Jay talks to Dan Auerbach and Pat Carney from the Black Keys. My schedule was overbooked. I wasn't able to join the conversation. And what a shame. They're an amazing band. I was really looking forward to it. So, Jay, what did I miss?
Well, you were definitely missed, Glenn, you know, but the show must go on, as they say. Yeah. And as you said, I spoke to Dan and Pat. We dug into a recent set list, their amazing new documentary. This is a film about the Black Keys, their new album, Ohio Players, and the fact that they've been playing together for over 20 years now.
I remember listening to the Black Keys debut album for Alive Records, The Big Come Up, released in 2002, and being really blown away by the soulful blues bass stripped down power. They moved to Fat Possum Records for Thick Freakness in 2003 and Rubber Factory the year after that. A really fitting label, I think, given the band's heavy blues sound. Yeah. And things got interesting when they moved to Nonesuch Records, and it wasn't until their second Nonesuch album, Attack and Release in 2008, that they had a real commercial breakthrough, the breakthrough that they deserved. And with the help of producer Danger Mouse, Attack and Release was a big hit and really a revelation that took traditional rock and transported it into a new century. And that set up the band for more success. Brothers in 2010 and El Camino in 2011, which produced the hit song Lonely Boy. And that topped the Billboard's U.S. Rock Songs and U.S. Alternative Songs charts.
Yeah, the band hasn't really even slowed down, though, releasing four more albums after El Camino. Their new album, Ohio Players, it's out April 5th through the band's own Easy Eye Sound imprint with Nonesuch. A few songs have already been released, and they're really good. Beautiful People Stay High, co-written by Beck, and it's a song you hear playing in the background right now. I Forgot to Be Your Lover, a cover of the 1968 William Bell song, and This Is Nowhere. So now, without further ado, hear the Black Keys Behind the Set List. Let it roll. Dan, Patrick, good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having us.
You have a lot of things going on right now. You've got a brand new album, Ohio Players, comes out April 5th. You've got this documentary. This is a film about Black Keys, which is fantastic. And the new single, Beautiful People, Stay High. The first thing I thought about when I read the album title was Love Roller Coaster and Fire. Were you guys fans of the Ohio Players, the band?
We're especially fans of their record covers. We were trying to think of a title for the album. We had a few contenders, and we've been doing these things we call record hangs, which are, I guess, they're DJ nights where we play 45s, exclusively 45s, and we have a nice guest. We have a guest usually join us, and you know, it's like a dance party, you know. And one of the guys we brought, he brought a Ohio Players 45, and it was a name that we've been kicking around, and we basically had to like name the record within the next week, and we took it as a sign, like we should just follow through here with this.
So such a great title.
We had to, go to the band, and we didn't have to, but we did. We went to the band, got their blessing, But yeah, you know, there's a lot of great music from Ohio, you know?
Yeah.
I was really big into the OJs when I was in middle school. But Guided by Voices are one of my favorite bands. Devo.
Such a great title. And it's so literal. Dan, you once said that, you know, that it took you until your sixth album to write your first quote unquote catchy song, you know, with Tighten Up from Brothers. I've only heard, I think, 5 or 6 tracks from Ohio Players, and it's full of catchy songs. I want to read you my notes. The first time I listened to it, I listened to This Is Nowhere, and I jotted down very catchy alt rock, Beautiful People Stay High, Big Sound, Anthemic, Joyful. But on the game, I wrote down More Hooks Than a Tackle Box, Infectious. Is that sort of a fair assessment?
It definitely is filled with hooks, but it felt amazing while we were cutting that. You know, that one in particular we wrote with Noel Gallagher. We went over to London to go write with him. And we went to a little studio called Toe Rag. It's in sort of like maybe the lesser known part of London. And it's down this alley, and it's like wet and cold, and you know, Noel had never been there, but that's where we went to meet up, and we ended up recording, writing 3 songs together, and it was absolutely amazing. But we're in the room; it's this tiny little small room. The studio is so small, it's hard to even explain. But it's just like only enough room to have a drum kit and a couple other people in there. We had a little keyboard, electric keyboard, and Noel was playing his guitar, and I had a guitar and a bass, and we were just in a circle in this tiny room, and that's the sound that you hear on the record. But it was amazing watching Noel go through the process of writing, and you know, just kind of like, you know, run through all the chords up and down the neck until he finds the one that like he hears in his mind is just right. You know, we just kind of like sitting patiently, you know, letting him do his thing. It was really cool to watch him go through his process.
Yeah, we were
amazing.
We were definitely like of the mentality while making this album, let's just try to make the best shit we possibly can. And so we wrote like 40 plus songs and finished maybe 28, and
wow,
just pared it down to the ones that all made sense together, and we're all kind of had a vibe that worked, you know. And I think, you know, it's like making a song like On the Game. If you think about all like the risks and things that you have to do to get to that point, which is, you know, fly yourself to London, meet up with a rock star who you don't really know that well, then go into a small studio that doesn't even have Pro Tools, write something from scratch, get a performance, make something that everybody's happy with, and then do it 3 days in a row. I mean, I remember after the first day, we got a song called You'll Pay. You know, we had everything but the lyrics. Dan did the lyrics once we got back to Nashville, but we got the performance and we got the structure of the song. And
yeah, we had the vocal melodies on there. We could hear how it was going to sound finished, you know?
Yeah. So, but I remember after the first song, I was like, man, we got what we need. And Dan's like, you know, let's get some more. And I was just like, you know, it's a lot of pressure to go back into the studio after getting something you already like. And we got 3 in 3 days, and we had a 4th day booked. And on the 4th day we showed up and we're like, this is not press our luck. We did some Morocco overdubs and just kind of shot the shit with Noel and hung out with him. He's the fucking coolest. And
nice,
you know. But the whole album is kind of like that, you know. It was like bringing back into the studio someone who we, you know, we've been huge fans of, and who's given us, he gave us a huge big break 20 years ago. But to like, you know, to ask these guys to come into the room with you, I guess you do take that risk of like, you want to make sure you know you're firing on all cylinders, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I listen to those songs, it reminds me of what you just said, Pat, about playing 45s. It sounded like a handful of 45s. I was listening to I Forgot to Be Your Lover. I mean, just heartbreaking lyrics, and it really evokes songs like Always on My Mind by Elvis. And when I listened to like Paper Crown, it sounded like one of those really great classic 70s sort of funk R&B songs that I love so much. Talk about your mindset of sort of putting together these songs, the ones that you ended up choosing for the album.
The record hangs that we were doing really influenced kind of the direction that the album went in. You know, we were pretty consistently going out there and spinning records and, like, you know, seeing what moved people on the dance floor, which is very different and like the ultimate test, you know. And I think we started to get so picky with the records, and we started to do the same when we were in the studio. And I think that just we didn't necessarily want to make songs that sounded like old 45s, but we wanted to have that same spirit.
Yeah, you know, it's like we started getting nutty with the collecting of, you know, these songs. Like Dan said, like what we want to be playing at these record hangs. It's like you want to play the song that should have been a hit, not just, you know, something that's obscure.
Yeah, you never want to play the hit. Maybe you can play one or two. We play one or two hits a night just to like appreciate maybe how good a couple hits are. But like for the most part, we want to play songs that hit people just like a hit song, and they've never heard it before.
So then you start paying attention to like these songs that you buy and you play, and like they just would not go over because they sound like a hit to you. But then you start really paying attention to like the arrangement of the tunes a lot, you know, which is aside from the melody and whatever, but it's like the way that a lot of those classic 45s are, it's like there's no wasted space, you know. And if there is, you can feel it, you know. You can feel like they shouldn't have done that.
You guys don't typically write songs in advance. You prefer that spontaneity of writing in the studio. Was Ohio Players written in the studio?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. We wrote it in a few different studios. We were kind of just like, we finished the last album and we just continued to record and never really stopped. And even when we were on tour, we would be in LA for an extended work trip. So we would book a week at Valentine Studios out there, or, you know, decide, let's try to write a song with Noel Gallagher. So we fly to London and book some time there. It was a big part of making the record, yeah. Being in the studio.
Yeah, typically we'll throw down some ideas and, you know, typically, you know, like we'll pursue it and we'll be able to tell within an hour or two if we should bank it or if we should keep going, you know. But coming up with like the initial idea of a song has never been like a problem for us, you know. But for this, we were definitely like, we had a lot of good stuff, that really great stuff actually, that we just, that was just, this didn't make the record because it was, you know, we were kind of, you know, thinking in terms of you know, making an album that was something that you could put on like on a Saturday night, had its ups and downs, but typically was, you know, mostly up, you know, like just like the record hangs, you know, like.
Yeah, it's very joyful. It's very uplifting. You have a documentary coming. It's premiering at South by Southwest. The title is This is a Film About the Black Keys. I had the pleasure of watching it. It was absolutely amazing. You've shared some very personal moments. It shows the challenges you face, but there's also a lot of joy and a lot of humor in there. What did you think about the finished film?
Hard for us to watch even a 2-minute interview, even when we're joking around a lot of times of ourselves. But the film, I think it was important, like, that we were able to kind of tell our story, you know, because it's like you know when you're an artist, your band, you're trying to, you gotta, like, I guess maybe, you know, you can sit on a podcast now and kind of you walk people through it, but to have the visuals, you know, but you know, a lot of times you're just waiting for like, you know, a writer to maybe write that piece that kind of tells the story, but it's, you know, in 20 plus years, it's never really existed. And I think for me, it was like the interesting aspect of the documentary is like making the document that for, you know, like a 16-year-old kid in Akron now could like access and be like, this is how it happened, you know? Cause for me, that was always very inspiring, hearing stories about, especially Devo, who are from Akron, but reading this one, the liner notes to this live Devo CD that my dad got me. It was recordings of before they got signed. And like, you know, there's a story about them driving to New York and playing at Maxis Kansas City and driving all the way back that night and getting a record deal from Warner Brothers like the next day, essentially, and Virgin. That was the kind of thing that kept me going when I was like a teenager. It was being like in Akron where, you know, there was like one record store. There wasn't much going on, but I would like open that up and I would like read that. It was like, you know, Greek mythology. It was like, this is the path. This is possible, you know?
Yeah. What did you think, Dan?
Yeah, no, it was definitely uncomfortable. A lot of squirming. I did a lot of squirming around in my seat.
In the early days, you got to know each other on some long van rides, and you really sort of bonded, connected over music. What were some of the CDs that you each brought into that van?
There were a ton because, you know, Dan especially, he every time we did a trip, he'd have like, you know, 100 CD booklet just crammed with.
Really I was living with my parents. I only spent money on music. Where all of my money went.
He's not joking. Like, I remember the first couple times he came over to my house when we were starting the band, and he had a minivan just filled with like, you know, obscure blues box sets and pouring out of the car.
What did you bring, Pat?
I mean, you know, we were always buying records, and I think, you know, one of the essential things was Dan bought a bootleg compilation at Shangri-La Records, a CD that they were selling like just on the counter called Black Chains and Exhaust of just rare.
Yeah, it's called Chains and Black Exhaust.
That's it.
Yeah. Amazing. And, mix.
That was like a game changer when Dan picked that up. You know, we just weared that thing out. I mean, we were listening to that soul jazz New Orleans funk comp right when it came out. That was another big thing. I remember
Safe as Milk was always on. And also the other Desert Session. What was that? B-Sides?
Yeah, the Mirror Man
Sessions. Mirror Man Sessions.
That was on.
That was an amazing record to drive around to.
We did a lot of late night drives, all night drives. You know, I remember listening to Pure Phase by Spiritualized a lot. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of stuff going on. We were, you know, we're still that way. Just like, just utterly consumed by music and very, very picky.
Yeah. There were so many great moments in the film. In retrospect, you know, there were moments that were crucial to sort of your creativity and the longevity of the band. For example, when you brought in Danger Mouse for Attack and Release, that was a bold move. Talk about that creative collaboration.
That started with Brian reaching out to us in early 2007, asking if we wanted to collaborate with him on an Ike Turner like comeback album, where Dan and I would write the songs in Akron, and then he would produce the songs and Ike would sing and play guitar. And from that, you know, we wrote a lot of songs. And Ike ended up cutting like three of them, I think. But we started that process in maybe February of 2007. And by May, we had like three songs done. And we had to make an album. You know, our business, our career was like, if we didn't have a record out the following year, we wouldn't have any money. So I remember flying to, I flew to LA and asked Brian to come out for a drink. And I just, without even consulting with Dan, was like, can we take these songs and just you produce them and they'd be Black Keys songs? And he was like, sure. And so that's how that kind of came about. So Dan picked the studio in Ohio and we went and recorded Attack and Release two or three weeks before Dan had his first child. It was like a pretty intense time. You know, it's us in the studio with the producer who we don't know that well for the first time. And we have 11 days to make the whole album and Dan's about to have a kid. But in that time, we end up learning quite a bit, I think, you know, from Brian. And that was the beginning of, you know, a deep friendship that we still have with him. When we made our next record, Brothers, after we had finished it, we did that on our own. After we finished what we thought was the record, I wasn't convinced that we had a single. I kind of started learning the importance of maybe having that. And I called Brian once again and asked him if he would do a song, and asked Dan, and we found the time in New York over 2 days in December of 2009. And it was the first time we went in the studio with the mentality, let's try to make a catchy song. And so we made this song called Tighten Up. And initially, Dan and I both didn't like it, especially Dan, because it didn't fit with the deep vibe of the rest of the album. And we were not convinced to put it on the album. And we were about to turn in the master for the record. I had our friend Leon Michaels over to my apartment, and I was playing him, you know, the MP3s of what the record was. And he's like, is that all you got? And I was like, no, we got this other song, but we're not going to put it on. And he said, let me hear it. And I played it, and he just started laughing. And he's like, you guys are fucking stupid if you don't put that record on. Put that song on your record. And I was like, really? He's like, oh, yeah, you're fucking dumb if you don't use that. So I texted Dan, and I was like, dude, Leon says we're idiots if you don't put this on. And I got a response the next day. He was like, does he just was like, put it on then.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You guys took a break from each other between Turn Blue and Let's Rock. And there's a great scene in the film, Dan, where you send Pat a photo of a gray sky. And Pat says something like, oh, you're in Akron. tell us about coming out of that break and recording Let's Rock. There were some really great collaborations on that one.
Yeah, well, one of the really fun ones was we finally got to collaborate with Billy Gibbons. And he was in town and we invited him over. That was absolutely amazing. We definitely listened to a lot of the first two ZZ Top records while we were out on the road in the early days in the band. Mm-hmm. Also, someone else we got to work with was Greg Cartwright. And that was sort of like when we started to branch out. And like, you know, I'd been living, even we'd both been living in Nashville for a decade by this time. And, you know, the whole music business here is based on musical partnerships, co-writing, people working together to create music. So it's like, and we come from Akron where you go in your basement by yourself and you come out a month later and you have a record. So, you know, after living here for like 10 years, we started to think maybe it would be fun to work with some other people, you know, you know, that's definitely kind of continued to carry over, especially on this new album.
I'm looking at your a recent set list from Park City, Utah. And I can't help but think you have now 12 studio albums to draw from, sort of an embarrassment of riches. How do you create that set list? Who creates a set list? What's that process like?
We create it together. And, you know, we're not a type of band that like whips out a different set list every night. We used to be more like that back in the day, I suppose. But the thing about
not
us
really.
Is we hate, well... Not really, yeah. But we hate rehearsing. That's the problem, you know? So it's, to me, it's
like... We don't like to rehearse. We like to create the songs. When we get together, we don't want to be practicing old stuff. We want to fucking make new stuff.
Honestly, we had to rehearse yesterday, and it was that we were doing some Delta Cream stuff, so it was different because we, you know, we play that stuff so infrequently but... Having to go through, like, honestly, we both just won't do it. Just hate rehearsing. So what we typically do is, you know, like when we're about to do a tour, we'll make sure we have like 25 songs that we can play and we'll just start playing the stuff that feels the best on stage. And, you know, I also look at it like a point of just how it felt for me as a teenager to go to a show, what I wanted to hear, you know, and like, I typically wanted to hear the most popular songs by whatever band, you know, like if I went to go see Modest Mouse, like I wanted to be familiar with the stuff that was coming out of the speakers, you know? And, so for us, it's like, we have 11 songs that are like certified gold or platinum. We play every one of those. And so when it comes into filling in the other nine, it's like play a couple new ones, play a couple deep cuts, stuff that we're interested in, maybe a cover, you know, but piece it together where it feels like a show, you know? I know, like, if we were to take our set list and just shuffle it all up, like, it's a methodical thing how we end up where we're at. You know, I remember this past summer we were on stage and we were doing some big European festivals, which we hadn't done in almost a decade. You know, we were kind of a little bit confounded about how to piece together a set list for 70,000 people. And we weren't headlining these things. We were like second to headliners. So it was a little bit different. Like if you're headlining like Coachella, you kind of just can just assume like there's a lot of people that probably know this stuff. But we were hanging out with Liam Gallagher actually in Milan. He was like, set list. He's like, play like your second biggest song second. we're like, what? He's like, yeah. He's like, hit them with the second biggest song right off the bat. Not first. Let them get their drinks and get situated, but then hit them with the big fucking song. And then you can play your last big hit last. But you got to give them something early on. Bait them through it. So we instantly changed the set list and put Gold on the Ceiling second.
Nice. In the set list we looked at, you played Beautiful People, Stay High from the upcoming Ohio Players album. Are there any other songs you think from the new album that could end up in your set list?
There's a lot.
I think,
you know, it's good to be able to utilize like one of the few things where analytics actually makes sense is like being able to see like what songs resonate with the fans. So you can kind of just look at Spotify after an album's been out for a couple months, and just see where people are gravitating towards, you know. But I think, you know, like On the Game is something that we, and This Is Nowhere, the two songs that you mentioned, those are definitely songs that will make the set list.
Well, as we sort of wrap up here, I wanted to ask you about the ending of your live show. Frequently it's, you know, a couple of songs from El Camino, quite possibly the best ending of a show ever, Little Black Submarines, and then into Lonely Boy. It's such a cool dynamic. Tell us about how you decide to close out your live shows.
Well, we arrived at that combo a while ago, and I'm not really sure how it happened, but we were making a set list one night, and that happened, and it just felt correct. And I think, you know, at this point now, we have enough songs to fill the main set with songs people are familiar with. But I think leaving people with two of your most popular songs is a good look. Sometimes we add a third song to that. You know, sometimes we'll do a three song encore.
What track is that, Pat?
When we do a three song encore, usually it'll be a cover or something.
Okay.
But. You know, I kind of prefer the festival sets where you just hit it, no encore, get the fuck off stage.
Thank you guys so much for taking the time out of your busy day to talk to us. Ohio Players, April 5th. This is a film about Black Keys premiering at South by Southwest. Any plans to hit the road?
Yeah, we'll be on tour in the U.S. this year, and we're hitting a little bit of Europe, and then I think more touring in 2025. Worldwide.
Congratulations and continued success, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks
so much
for having us.